Welcome to the FinTech Scaling Show. This podcast is sponsored by Scale Up Consulting, helping FinTech startups create a scalable organization to support an ever-increasing demand. When you're ready to grow, reach out to us at richard@scaleupconsulting.co. Now, over to the show with Richard Doty, founder and host. Hello, FinTech leaders. Today on the show, we're excited to have Daniel, founder and CEO of Equitium. So Daniel is a true entrepreneur. I met him a few weeks ago and we had a good chat and he told me how he set up his business. And I thought, wow, this is something that we need to discuss in more detail. So, you know, he's spearheaded Equitium over the last 8 years, spearheaded both the vision and also the growth. So we're super excited to have you on the show today, Daniel. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, Richard. Great to be here, for sure.
Awesome. So listen, let's kick off the show. And what I like to do always at the start of the show is give the listeners a bit of background and insights into you, your life, and maybe we can help them understand how you came up sort of with the idea of Equitium, because I know it's a pretty good story.
Yeah, well, like basically since I was about 15 or so, I've been always passionate about like coding and computers, making little games, making little websites. But then I was getting down the rabbit hole of that and I said, okay, I'm going to lock myself up in a dark room if I continue down this path. So I picked up finance instead. And then just after the master, I really got sort of attracted by private companies more than public ones, more than seeking alphas on stocks and things like that. Yeah. And I said, okay, maybe we can do something by, you know, if you know finance, if you know coding, right? Maybe we can do something. And we started actually with a blog trying to help entrepreneurs basically use financial concepts to their advantage. A lot of entrepreneurs, they come from their industries, right? So being it real estate, biotech, coding, software engineering, whatever it is. And so most of the times, or a lot of the times, they underutilize finance. And we started this blog and we got a lot of reactions on valuation, of course. So valuation is the central financial question that entrepreneurs have. And we saw investors doing it on a daily basis, you know, 2, 3, 4 times for every opportunity they have, while an entrepreneur only encounters it like every year, year and a half. And so they are unprepared for an important discussion. And we said, okay, we can do something about this with software. And that's how Equitium came about. We really said, okay, we can help. You know, it's a difficult calculation. It's more like a lot of people think it's more art than science. But if it is so difficult, right, like we can definitely help a lot by at least putting together all the data that is available online, all the knowledge that has been built up by experts over the years, and just make it into a do-it-yourself package that entrepreneurs can use. And that's what Equitium does.
And you mentioned you're studying and you're in university, you're doing a master's degree and you're attracted by private companies. I mean, what was the attraction?
Well, the attraction for me is the incredible inefficiencies. Like, so like, but it's interesting that there are some small companies or so that are doing great without having ever considered, like, you know, a growth strategy, right? Or rebuilding their website, reinvesting their profits, right? Or like having ever considered what percentage of profits to reinvest, how to, you know, consider different opportunities and compare them. And so there's like, for me, there's, whereas on the stock market, you cannot, like, you need to really do a lot of work or do a lot to move the needle by a very, very little bit. On private companies, the opportunities are huge, I think. Mm-hmm. And that's what was really interesting for me. Yeah.
And you mentioned inefficiencies and you rattled off a couple of examples there. What other inefficiencies did you guys find out and explore during that blogging phase of the startup?
Well, for us, it was about finance, right? So it was about, okay, explaining entrepreneurs, for example, like a very common theory in finance, the pecking order theory of financial resources, right? The first thing that you try is debt. The second thing is equity. And why don't startups raise debt, right? things like that. And we were really trying to explain the theory behind it, because I'm a real believer, if you know the model, if you know the mental model on how to interpret that situation, you're going to make a much better decision.
And then so talk me through this. So you guys explored that. You came up with obviously the idea around valuations. Then you went about and you building the tech. And obviously building tech, you're going to have to somehow get data sources from places. And my assumption is this is going to be quite difficult because it's quite, maybe the word is opaque and difficult to find. Yeah, I was wondering how you guys went about building that out.
Yeah, I mean, so in the early days, we really took to heart that thing of like, if you're not ashamed about your first version, you've launched too late. Because I'm still ashamed to this day, you know. So we launched our first alpha, which we never called an alpha, in 2 weeks.
Nice.
And yeah, and that was really like, it was just an Excel file with a Google form and with a landing page made from like very, very simple thing. And it was, it had a PayPal link to pay, you know?
Yeah.
And it was a whole lot of a manual process where we would like basically report these inputs from the Google form to our Excel file. And then the Excel file would generate the report. We would just print as PDF, like a sheet of the Excel file. And this would be the report. So it was a very manual process. But it allowed us to validate a lot, right? It allowed us to, like we said, okay, there's no way. If this thing turns like any revenue at all, right? There's a need for what we're doing. Because like, there's no way that somebody goes through the pain of like paying some shady, you know, people from the Netherlands in, you know, through a PayPal form, right? Just to get this valuation, right? You know? And it actually worked. We actually got a couple of customers, nothing crazy, right? But out of a, like a 20 euro AdWords campaign or something. Yeah. So, you know, that was enough for us to go on. The data, is difficult to find indeed, but it's always like for me, I think for any valuation professional, right? You kind of start with what you want and then you see what you end up with. Like you broaden the search basically, no?
Yeah.
And we saw that data was available. It was broad, but it was still interesting to have, you know, compared to no data, because the opposite, right? The opposite is no data at all. It's like people that don't know what to look for going online for days, right? Trying to look for competitors, for comparables, without knowing where the data is, without knowing what is a competitor, without knowing how to broaden the search. Mm. That's the alternative. Either that or pay somebody that is generally a highly specialized professional, which comes with its own cost, right?
Yeah.
To do this, which at an early stage for like a 50 to 200K fundraise doesn't make sense at all, like financially. Yeah.
And tell me, I mean, so what are the, maybe going into some detail here, but what are the data sources that that you guys look for and bring in order to get a proper valuation on an early stage startup?
Yeah. I mean, it depends on the methods that you use. We use three financial methods for which we need to have a bit of like, comparables as good as possible. So like ideally multiples for EBITDA. We also use failure rates of companies at early stages. We use, of course, country return rates, like risk-free rates and things like that. And then the other two methods that we have, they compare the startup with other startups. And so for that, we try to scoop up every valuation available online and use that as comparables as well. Yeah.
Okay. And if I'm a early stage startup founder and I come to you guys and I say, listen, I need a bit of help. You know, I want to raise. How can you help me? What's the case study that you got that you can walk us through to, in this instance, take me from, okay, I need help. I need a valuation. I want to raise. Can you provide a little case study for us?
Yeah. So the people that come with us, they come to us, they are encountering two different situations. So on one hand, they are planning a raise. So they're thinking like, I'm going to raise money like in the next, you know, 3 months, I'm going to start my funding round that is going to last another like 3 to 6 months. And I need to raise this money. And so they're preparing the documents, and the documents that they're preparing are their pitch deck, their financials, and their valuation generally. The other case is that they got an offer because either they did like a pitch somehow, or they got a friend of a friend, or an investor reached out, and they have an offer and they want to counter it, right? They wanna have a different story for their valuation. Mm. And what they do is that, like, at least 90% of our customers, they just go on Equidem and they register to the platform. It's a guided 35 multiple choices questionnaire. After that, they provide a minimum of 3 years of financial projections, just yearly numbers that we advise people to have in advance before registering to the platform. And then the platform automatically calculates the value of the company with 5 methods, generates a PDF report of about 25 pages, which then has all the information necessary for either for them to discuss it with the investors or just for the investor to get an idea of the valuation of this company from the point of view of the sales side. And then from there is a discussion and a negotiation, which we try to help by focusing the discussion on the assumptions. No? So valuation, it is very uncertain, but the uncertainty at an early stage is not on the calculation itself, is more on the expectations about the company. No? So every founder is over optimistic, right? Otherwise they would be, they wouldn't be a founder, right? That's just like, they're overconfident somehow. And then, but then of course, right, you need to, in order to agree on a deal, you need to agree on expectations about the company with what the market can support and what the market can believe. It's not only you, right? It's a deal. And so we try to have the investor and the founder come together and discuss those assumptions and maybe come back on Equidem, change them and see what's the calculation again, right? And to the point where they agree basically. And that's what we do. Yeah.
And I was wondering how this ecosystem sort of fits together. You mentioned the founder, you mentioned the tech, and you mentioned the investor. Are they all included in the system, or is it the founder and the tech, and then that information with inside there gets sort of passed on some way to the investor?
Yeah, it's the second one that you mentioned. So the founder, we're mostly serving founders. So we're also serving like advisors and investors and VCs, but there isn't a connection on platform itself, because this is an activity that still the two parties want to do independently. Everybody wants to make their own calculations and then come together. That's just what we found more useful for people. Yeah.
No, I hear you. And you know, as you started this out as a blog, then you went to alpha pretty quickly with your spreadsheet, and then you've built up the product over time and also the team over time. You know, during that journey, how have you guys internally, how have you approached decision-making and making certain that you do have sort of that strategy that you mentioned and the right things are being invested at a point in time?
Yeah. Well,
turn it back.
Badly. No. It was definitely a learning process. Like, I mean, we started with a background in finance and a bit of programming and... Yeah. Yeah, not really, you know, even considering this as a part or as a skill that you should have, as a process that you should think about, right? And so, like, I mean, a lot of trial and error, but I mean, how do we approach it now? Like, we try to approach it rationally, which is already like something, right? That you go through, right? Some people just want to do what feels right or something. Like, I think for us, we try to approach it rationally. And of course, we do valuation, right? So valuation is the ultimate decision maker in, like, you know, the only variable that puts together risk and return. So we have to make our decisions rationally. But also, like, and also the other criteria that I think is very important is for the good of the company. So that kind of takes away, hopefully, egos and, you know, attachment of people to ideas and things like that. So, and as well, it works to unify all of us and to incentivize the differences, right? Because differences are very, very welcomed in doing the good of the company again.
In those two things, I mean, you touched on some really great points there. So making rational decisions and making certain that you do things for the good of the company, the employees. So it sounds like you're also building out a culture of inclusiveness.
Yeah, I hope so. I hope so. Like, I think like you have to be aligned on some values, right? For example, these ones, right? For example, like believing in rationality, right? Believing in making rational decisions, and that's the best for everybody, right? And also having a value of like having your ego kind of come second, or at least, you know, keeping it in check to some extent, right? And seeing that as a virtue, that those things have to be there. But then everything else, like, I think the nice thing is that everybody's able to push in their own direction and see how this basically moves our capability frontier, right? Like it moves it forward. And yeah, so I think that's nice. It's a nice way to work. It's a nice way to empower everybody. And definitely, yeah, also foster inclusion as well, yeah.
Because you mentioned empowerment, you mentioned own direction, and that just strikes me as leadership, right? Giving people the space to become leaders. And is there a certain style or a certain method or that you've thought of and try to implement as you've led your business and grown it over the last few years?
I think like I've developed an habit of like over-delegating kind of, you know?
It's a
good habit, right? But but it can go overboard because the moment somebody says like, oh, you know, I can give a crack at that, right? And they've never encountered the issue before, right? They're like super junior. I'm going like, okay, sure. Like that's yours, right? But I think like that's somewhat key. The other thing that is very difficult that I think like we're seeing more and more now is that everybody is bringing their own whole life to work, right? And they want to have, or they already have, some secondary connecting activities, right? Maybe they have their own newsletter, they have their own followers on Twitch, they have whatever it is, right?
Yeah.
And so like I think I'm trying to do, and like what I think is very nice is like foster that individuality as well, right? So I think if you look at it like 5 years from now or so, it's going to be part of it for sure. Like your product manager, if he's very good, right, he's going to have 300 followers or like 3,000 or 300,000 followers on GitHub, right? He's going to have a Twitch channel where he discusses product management. He's going to write books, right? So how do you include that in also like an employment relationship, whatever that means, right? It's not even anymore an employment relationship if you are remote, if you are, you know, in a different country, right? So, but I see this getting more and more fluid. And then it's interesting, like, how do you empower a leader to be a leader, not only within the organization, because that's relatively easy, right? But even outside, and how does he combine, or he or she combines the two roles that they have, right?
I mean, that's a very yeah, that is an interesting point. And what are you guys doing in this instance? I mean, because you raise up a very, very interesting point. Twitter followers, you know, LinkedIn followers, whatever it is, writing books. What are you guys doing to allow people to express themselves, right? Because that's what you're talking about.
Yeah, I mean, I think we are like, well, first giving them the freedom to do so. Because, I mean, if you work for some companies, right, there are certain things that you can post online. There are certain things that you cannot, right? And you have a code of conduct as an employee, and people have been fired for what they post online, right?
Yeah.
Which in some cases, right? I mean, of course. But so that's the first thing. And second, I think, is more like viewing these relationships not as in a classical sense of like, okay, you work for this person. That's what you do. You try to help this person be successful. That's not going to fly, right? You work independently. You are a person, and you are included in this group. And together, this group does much more for each of its own individuals, right? And yeah, and I think that's the mentality. And then for sure, like we're wondering, because for founders is easy, I think, because founders are already aligned, right? The only thing your Facebook profile talks about is your company, right? I haven't been on Facebook for 3 years. You know? But for employees that are like, you know, also influencers, or they're very, very good. And if they're very, very good, they're going to be influencers, right? Their whole Facebook profile is not their company, right? Because they're working for something else. So it's interesting. It's very interesting.
Because this could also, you know, if we dive into it a bit more, like you have founders and you have employees in a company. And I guess, you know, one part of a company is the product side, and we've chatted through that. And another part is business development, and business development includes PR, marketing, sales. And if you give, just to sort of stay on that business development angle for a second, if you give your employees the freedom to communicate their expertise out, they can act as catalysts. Exactly. And they, in a way, are doing work of PR and marketing. So they're getting those inbound leads in a way. And you should embrace that, right?
Yeah. Yeah, and what's the normal thing, right? The normal thing is that the client list that you have is like almost not yours, right? At a normal company, right? It belongs to the company. You have a non-compete afterwards. You can never talk to the same people again, almost, right? And like, what's the opposite, right? The opposite is the influencer that one day endorses one product, the next day, and you know, I mean, we're talking about influencers for socks or something, but if you think about for enterprise software, right, it's kind of the same thing. Like the guy that sold you 5 good solutions is gonna also find the 6th one, right? Mm. And I think like, if you look at that as a value, right, you could have a person that again has their own, you know, maybe promotes more than one product or endorses more than one product, and the client list is almost like, it's his client list, right? And less of the company. So yeah, I think it's the same. Yeah, the same story applies there for sure.
Yeah. And on that note, I mean, as you guys have moved through the gears, how have you approached that sort of the business development block of PR and marketing to not only scale, but, you know, grow your audience, make certain prospects aware of you and current clients also wanting to reach in?
Well, we don't do that much business development in the sense of custom solutions for a specific client. We mostly do we try to keep our standard solution. And the way that I always thought about marketing that is as a competitive game. No, so like you're competing against other marketing, basically, from other products for the attention of people. And so, in my opinion, the only way to win that is either to play your competitive advantage. No, so if your competitive advantage is that you get a premium price, right, then you outbid the other person because you have a higher margin. But for us, our competitive advantage is the data that we collect, right? That we're absolutely not sharing, like, you know, individually for the companies, but we are analyzing internally, making averages, and then sharing that back as a basically to inform other founders of like what's normal, right? For example, we have an article about what's an average forecasted growth for startups in different stages, in different industries, so on and so forth. And that information is our competitive advantage because nobody else or close to nobody else in the world has that type of information. And so, you know, that article had been first on Google for a very long time, and it's brought us a lot of leads. Yeah.
And you know, what else do you guys do in this space? I mean, you mentioned Google, you've mentioned influencers. Do you use these social, you know, these tactics to help, I guess, get the word out there and get your message out there? You know, maybe LinkedIn as well. I guess people hang out there as well for different things.
Yeah, so influencers, not that much. Like, it's a very dry topic. Maybe we'll do more on that. We still have to crack the code on that side. But the thing is that valuation is a very spot need, no? Because it happens, that instant. And so, like, what we saw so far is that the most effective marketing is more about not trying to target, like for shoes, trying to target somebody that is passionate about shoes and he's going to buy an additional pair. That doesn't work for us. It's more like trying to target the moment when you need valuation, right? So the audience is, of course, founders, CFOs, CEOs, and so on. But the moment is the very important thing. So for us, Google Ads and Google Search work really, really well. And now the interesting thing is now, though, every platform is getting smarter at that, you know? So from Instagram to Facebook to Twitter, because on Facebook, the key thing is target the audience and the demographic, right? You want that's what Facebook allows you to do very, very easily. Mm. While on Google, you target the moment because you're only going to search for that thing when you need that thing, right? Mm. So, but what you're seeing is that all the other platforms are also getting smarter in this. Mm. And I don't know, like you get ads for shoes only when you are thinking about buying new shoes, right?
Yeah.
We're giving it a second or third maybe crack this year. Yeah. Let's see how it goes. Yeah.
Oh, awesome. Okay. And we've spoken a bit about the, I guess, some of the structures, that the detail around some of the structures around PR and marketing. But when you set off and you started putting in operational structures in your business, what are the first, maybe the first things that you're thinking about in order to help you out and sort of support your growth going forward?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think like what I sort of found, again, like we did a lot of trial and error on this. Like, you know, I think it's like more of a question of what we didn't try than what we tried, right? But but I think like what works well is like, okay, you have like one priority is definitely like the growth, right? And like sometimes because I don't know if it's because we are like more product people or because, you know, it's difficult to have growth as a target because that's not really a target, you know, it's more like a measure, like, you know,
so
that's a bit difficult, but like it happens sometimes that you kind of lose that North Star. Right. Mm. And so I think like the first thing to think about is like, okay, and maybe monitor as well, right? How much time, what's the percentage of company time? What's the percentage of company budget that is spent on that priority, right?
Yeah.
And monitor that, you know? And like, if it's, I don't know, if it's below like what, 60, 70% or so, like, yeah, is that because you're pivoting and like what you were doing doesn't work, then fine, right? But when you find that sort of little bit of product market fit, then if you don't have 70, 80% of your budget and time in exploiting that, then maybe like reevaluate, right? And then, yeah, how to do it? Yeah, that's the big question, right? Yeah.
Because I mean, the other way that when I've been speaking to colleagues and founders, CEOs, and fintech leaders, I always also want to ask them, how do you, as you grow and as you get older and more mature, how do you make certain that you as the founder or leader, visionary, are working on the business and not in the business?
Yeah.
I don't know if you have any insights on that.
I think if you read Principles from Ray Dalio, very nice book, right? He always says he is the chief investment officer because it's an investment fund. His company is an investment fund, but also the CEO. So he always had to have two jobs, right? And the way he did it is that he just worked 80 hours a week. So he was like, he was chief investment officer until 6 p.m. or whatever. And then the rest of the day he was. So I don't know if that works for everybody. I mean, if you see it like, right? I mean, Musk as well, it's like chief product officer for sure. Jobs as well. So I don't know. Maybe that's just what people do. Yeah, I think that's kind of the most difficult thing. Like you need to, you know, and that's why you end up doing more because during the day you have your normal job, you have tasks, you have to support people, you know, in actual operational things. But then you also need to, again, paraphrasing Ray Dalio, think about improving the machine, right? So not only making the machine produce things, but also improve the machine itself, right?
Yeah.
And I think there is no easy solution for that. Yeah.
Yeah, I hear you. And in improving the machine, what are you guys at Equitum doing? I mean, are you looking at things in cycles? You know, every 90 days, we're going to do 90-day sprints and we're going to focus on that for 90 days or maybe a bit of a longer cycle, 6 months, and make certain that the stuff delivered is reviewed and then you move on. How do you view sort of improvements and optimization?
Yeah, so again, that's also like a... not an easy thing.
I'm asking horrible questions.
No, you're asking great questions, right? If it was easy, then it was. We do it in we revise our strategy every quarter, and we have priorities for the quarter after. We divide the priorities in improving the core, which is what we were saying before of the 70%, to make sure that we don't lose sight of that. And then we have one or two extra, let's say, exploration activities that we do. And we don't keep it extremely tight in the sense that we are still, I think, at a point where, you know, flexibility is more valuable than output, just measured output.
Mm.
And that's what we do. And then every 3 months, reevaluate the next quarter in the context of where we're going in a longer context. And the longer context, hopefully doesn't change too much. And hopefully changes enough, but try to revise it also every three months, but then like kind of every year and a half, you have a big revision generally.
Makes sense. And you know, as you guys continue on that growth journey and continue moving along and building your business as a senior team and as the founder and CEO, what questions are you asking yourselves? And also, what factors, i.e. like Brexit, are you considering as you move forward?
Yeah. So I think like for the specific business that we are in, the barriers to growth right now are more internal than external. So my main questions are, how do we scale the team? Are we focusing on the right activities? Are we spending our energies effectively? Are the support systems set up so everybody like can do the right things? Those are the main questions. And of course, like the question there is like, how do we scale the team? Right now we are 8 people. So we're right at the point where, you know, communication starts breaking down. You cannot have everybody. It's the one pizza or two pizza principle of Jeff Bezos, right? Like you can only, when you start having more than two pizzas, like communication kind of breaks down. Yeah. And how do we go from here to the next phase where you basically have two levels? Yeah. And externally, like, I mean, the interesting thing externally is like trying to monitor, okay, what are the big shifts? Big shift for us is probably definitely crypto, where you have, you know, a lot of startups fundraising on chain instead of fundraising through a normal angel investor, VC or something like that. And of course, we're keeping a good tab on that. We are helping companies with the valuation on chain as well. And it's an interesting thing for us. And it's going to be fun to see, okay, what's in 10 years, what's the percentage of companies that are going to just have all their shares on on a ledger and on a blockchain and how does that affect what we do? Yeah.
No, cool. That sounds extremely interesting. I mean, especially the last part when you're saying, you know, founders are looking at using different assets to raise and different mediums to raise funds. That sounds pretty exciting. Are you guys thinking of writing an article or blog around that at some point in time? Because it sounds, you know, quite an interesting topic.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, for sure. Like as soon as we see how to position ourselves, because it's quite different, right? I mean, first you have a whole spectrum of, it's not only shares, right? For startups, you kind of have, especially in the US, but you have, you know, your corporation that has a number of shares, 10% goes to the investor. The rights that those shares have are pretty specified. On tokens, you have all the spectrum, right? From one side, like a pure currency that has no rights, basically aside from measuring, you know, that one share is worth $10 and it can be exchanged. And on the other end of the spectrum, you have tokens that resemble exactly shares, right? So they have voting rights, they have cash flow rights, exactly the same. So, and everything in between, right? So yeah, so the valuation changes also according to this. It's just that you don't see that complexity in normal startups. And the other interesting thing is that when you do that type of company, you have a public company from day one, right? So your share price is public and it fluctuates according to supply and demand. And you need to supply information and to, because it changes in theory according to information and speculation, but it should change only for information. And nobody's going to publish about your company, right? I mean, it's a tiny startup, right? So the information is your blog, right? So you need to manage like, you know, hundreds of thousands of investors, right, from day zero. So it's an interesting market for sure. It's an interesting movement.
Cool. Looking forward to hearing more about that. And listen, I always ask guests on the show, as they've been learning, as they've been maturing in their businesses, what books have you either read? I know you've mentioned a couple already, but what books have you either read in the past or are reading right now, or even podcasts or YouTube channels that you think our listeners would benefit from?
Yeah, that's a good question. So I think recently I read Million Dollar Coach from Eric Smith. Yeah, that's very nice because it explains a lot about like the sort of tensions that can arise naturally in teams of humans because we're not robots, right? And how to kind of diffuse them, and just a great book. And otherwise, I mean, Principles from Ray Dalio. Interesting.
And anything on valuations? I'm thinking that there might be something out there that you've read in the past that would be quite interesting for sort of startups and scales.
Yeah. Yeah, you pose a good question there. We should probably write something about that because there isn't really Yeah, there isn't really anything. Maybe I'm not the best person to ask because I don't read really the books about it, maybe.
Yeah.
But no, the main thing, the best thing for me is about valuation, like understanding the first principles, right? So, and the best way to do that, I think there is a book from McKinsey, which is just the university book about valuation, basically.
Yeah.
And it's a huge book. But the first chapter or the first two chapters are, they lay down all the first principles that you have. So why do we look at cash flow? Why is a company with like a whiteboard and a laptop worth 5 million, and like all these type of things are there. And I think that's the most important thing for the calculations itself. Yeah. Luckily there's a company that has the solution and it's online, it's available. And
there we go.
Yeah.
And we're talking to them. Okay, cool. Listen, it's been awesome. Catching up and chatting with you today. How can listeners get in touch with you guys at Equidem?
Yeah, well, definitely through our website, equidem.com. We have a chat there. You can write to us on info@equidem.com or to me on LinkedIn, just Daniel Faloppa on LinkedIn. And yeah, looking forward to connect.
Great. Awesome. I really enjoyed the conversation today. And I love going into the detail around certain topics, especially around the data and how you guys use it. I think it was some awesome insights. So thanks, mate, for coming on the show. Loved it. Oh, and looking forward to watching you guys go and grow.
Thank you. Thank you, Richard. It was great. Thank you for the questions. And yeah, best of luck to you too. For sure. It was a pleasure.
Awesome, mate.